Hello everyone, my name is Anya Kennedy and I'm the Order of the HIST. I'm thrilled to be having you all here. Just to do some quick housekeeping before we get into the part you're all here for. Tonight's debate is a collaboration between the College Historical Society of Trinity College Dublin and the Literary and Scientific Society of Queen's University Belfast. And all things going well, we hope this will become like an annual tradition. And so it's really lovely to have you all here for what couldn't be a better inaugural debate. And particularly to have it in such a wonderful venue and the home of Northern Irish politics and with so many distinguished guests here. So in that vein, I just want to give a few quick thank yous before we kick off. And firstly to Cara Hunter, MLA for hosting us all here and for the entire team at Stormont really for just making this all so easy and great. Thank you so much. And including our wonderful tour guide from earlier. And everyone from the HIST and Literific who helped to make today happen, and particularly Monica Magnar, Daniel Toft, Talto McSparren, and Dermot Hamill. And thank you very much to all of you for being here. And it's so great to have so many students from both Trinity and Queen's. And it's also wonderful to have lots of lovely guests from both societies too, and particularly Martin Craig, Sir Donald Deeney. It's so lovely to have you all. And finally, of course, to all of our wonderful speakers, thank you so, so much. You can't have a debate without some debaters. So we really, really appreciate you all and taking the time to come, and we're really looking forward to hearing your speeches. And with that, I would like to call on Cara Hunter to officially introduce tonight's debate. Thank you.
For that, Anya. It's great to be here. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the 15th ordinary meeting of the 175th Literific Society here in Stormont, which I know you've had the pleasure of having a tour of earlier today. It is my pleasure to be here today and to sponsor this event as an MLA, and today's debate is the inaugural annual Stormont debate hosted by the College Historical Society of Trinity College Dublin and the Literary and Scientific Society of Queen's University Belfast. And I think it's fantastic to see so many people here, so many young people here, with an interest in public speaking and developing their debating skills. Constructive debate is a crucial part of any democracy, and that is perhaps even more true here in Northern Ireland. Having read the minutes of some of the previously held debates, I have had to credit the Literific Society for the diverse range of issues that have been debated, as well as the incredibly diligent minutes taken, which demonstrates vital accountability and a seriousness that the topics you've discussed deserve. The debate today, I am sure, will inspire some fantastic back and forth, with the topic being this House believes the Republic has forgotten about Northern Ireland. And there are very few people better positioned to be here today regarding the relationship between North and South than a man who has played, and I'm sure will continue to play, a defining role in our shared history. I am delighted to have here today a peacemaker in this part of the world, former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. During events in Northern Ireland, and continued to prove incredibly difficult to manage. There were many turbulent events here, including the Drumcree standoff, the tragedy and political crisis in the aftermath of the Oma bomb, and many other events. Despite this, Bertie and his commitment to peace, alongside other leaders such as John Hume, did not waver, and we will not forget their commitment to peace here in the North. We are extremely grateful for his role that he played in our peace process as a key architect of the Good Friday Agreement, often putting aside his own personal circumstances to pursue a better future for this island and for our generation. And I know I am grateful, as many here today will be, that we were blessed with the opportunity to grow up in a time of peace. I must also welcome your president, Daniel Toft, and auditor of the HIST, Anya Kennedy. Two very impressive young people I've had the pleasure of meeting today, and I look forward to hearing more from. So you're all in very safe hands here today. Good luck to both sides of our distinguished guests here today. Thank you very much for joining us, and I wish you all the best and look forward to this debate. Thank you.
I would now like to call on President of the Literific and Daniel Toft to introduce the standing orders for tonight's debate.
Scotland, it's fantastic to see the two societies getting together again. So I'm just going to run through the rules of the debate. Each guest speech is up to 10 minutes long, and each student speech is 7 minutes long, with the first and last minute of the speech being protected time, and that will be signalled by the bell. You must not attempt to raise a point of information within the protected time, but to POI, raise your hand and say point of information on that point or just POI. Please keep your POI to 10 seconds and no barriers, meaning wait at least 15 seconds after giving a POI to ask another one or to ask one if someone else has asked one. If you need to leave the room at any time, do so quietly between speeches. Do not leave or re-enter the room whilst the speaker is speaking. And lastly, if you are a literate member, in accordance to the traditions of the society, if you swear during a speech, you will be fined a bottle of port to be presented at the next ordinary meeting. Thank you.
And for all their help in organising such a wonderful event. And if you're the Liverpool speakers, please do swear. I think that sounds great. But with that in mind, I'm thrilled that we can go on to the actual debate now. And I would like to call Mr. Bertie Ahern to the chair.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Anya, I want to thank Daniel for their very strict rules, so that makes my life easy. You've heard them once, so I won't have to say them again. I want to thank you, Ciara, for your kind words, and I wish you well. I'm delighted to come here when Ciara is back working again, because I've been here so many times in the last year, and to say the place looked a bit lonely is an understatement, so it's great to be able to be. The one person that was here all the time during the difficulties in the last few years was the Speaker, so it's good to see new Speaker, Deputy Speaker, to be here with you all. Well done to everyone for organising this. I do understand it's the plan to keep this going for evermore. So we're all honoured to be here for the start of it, and I want to thank the auditor, I want to thank the president for their work. Having attended lots of different debates and with the speaker I was in, we started off in the autumn back at another debate in University College Dublin, so I was delighted to say that next time that I met him was here, when he's now speaker. But I want to thank you for all the work you do, because I do know the others and the president that it's tough going, it's hard work, and for everybody behind it, I want to thank everyone who's in touch with my office to make all the arrangements. I do appreciate the amount of effort to keep these great traditional organisations going, to keep the Israeli and Scientific Society of Queens, to keep the History and Historical Society. It is tremendous history, and we were talking about the book at the start when I was signing it, but the great history that there is in these books, other than I told you should write a book on that. Anyway, let's get on. I'll say a few words at the end, and I want to call the House to order. The question before the House this evening is that the House believes the Republic has forgotten Northern Ireland. So that's the challenge to our speakers and our guest speakers. I want to wish them well. Prior to Anya and Daniel will act as tellers for this, but prior to calling on the first speaker to begin the debate, I'd like to put the question to the House on the motion at hand, because that's the tradition. For those not familiar, the question is put at the start, the question is put at the end, and in between we'd see if anyone influenced anybody, which I'm sure the speakers will have a huge influence on everybody. So we're going to repeat this process at the end, so just in case you think we're all gone mad, and that the eight speakers aren't going to influence anything. So we're going to put the question, so if I can put the question and ask all those in favour, please raise your hands.
All those against? Emma Souza is going to be the first speaker to propose the motion that the House and begin the debate.
Thank you, Chair. I and my colleagues on this side of the bench will be asking this House to adopt the motion that the Republic has forgotten Northern Ireland. I will make this case on 3 points. Representation, the divide between people north and south, and legacy of partition. I expect that the opposition will argue that successive Irish governments have demonstrated continued support and resources to Northern Ireland through the Good Friday Agreement and subsequently post-Brexit. However, warm words butter no parsnips. Political leaders in the Republic might like to talk about Northern Ireland, but fail at every opportunity to provide meaningful inclusion and participation. Fianna Micheál Martin has said that too little has been done to build understanding and cooperation between Ireland North and South since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, but has neglected to acknowledge or recognise the failings of the Irish government itself in building a truly shared Ireland. At every opportunity, successive governments led by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have failed the litmus test of turning rhetoric about Northern inclusion into action. Since the finalisation of the Good Friday Agreement, there has been just 2 Taoiseach nominations for a Northern Ireland resident to the Seanad, the last of which was in 2011, and neither of whom were women. Since 2002, there have been 55 Taoiseach nominations. 2 of those were for somebody from the north. There is no better an example of how superficial the current coalition party's commitment to including Northern voices is than the fact that they failed to nominate even one resident from the north to the Seanad in 2020. At a critical time for north-south, east-west relations, when Northern Ireland was struggling for a voice, having lost MEP representation, the Irish government opted to instead use the Taoiseach nominations as a political carve-up, placing their party political candidates into the seats and leaving Northern Ireland with no representation. If this government were genuine about building understanding, breaking down barriers north and south, and including Northern voices, then one might expect to see unambiguous efforts to boost representation and inclusion on their behalf. The Taoiseach nominations shouldn't be exploited as a means for parties to plant the candidates they hope to run the next time, or to gift their colleagues who already lost their seat a new role. It should be about increasing representation for underrepresented communities.
Do you think nominating a few soft nationalists and the occasional soft unions to the Seanad really going to break down a major division?
No, but I do think that having 3 representing one of the 3 major divisions in the north, the unionist, nationalist, and others, would certainly help in building understanding. There are a lot of outdated ideas about what Northern Ireland is today, and one way to change that is for more Northern voices to be heard in the chamber. Certainly it would be much better for our voices to be heard versus having people in Dublin speaking for us. History shows us that when given the opportunity to enter the chamber, representatives from Northern Ireland don't squander it. I'm looking at one such person right here. What we have in place of representation is a litany of failed commitments and promises. Observer status for Northern Ireland in European Parliament, rejected. speaking rights for MLAs and MPs from Northern Ireland and the Dáil and Shannon, blocked by the government. A referendum on extending presidential voting rights to Irish citizens in Northern Ireland and abroad, indefinitely extended. In the Northern context, extending the presidential franchise is one small act with a significant personal impact for Irish citizens, who for too long have been marginalised. That the government has not only failed to deliver on this referendum, but has completely discarded the idea altogether, is yet another missed opportunity to give voice to people in Northern Ireland. Outside of the well-intentioned but toothless shared island dialogue series, what meaningful change or effort has this government made to increase dialogue and build understanding across this island? It is notable also that there's actually nobody from Northern Ireland that works within the shared island unit. The key to greater understanding is no secret, it is dialogue. We need more spaces for all island conversations on the issues impacting the everyday lives of citizens of both sides of this border. The Citizens' Assembly on Climate and Biodiversity would have been a prime opportunity to build just this kind of dialogue and in turn greater understanding north and south. Yet no effort was made to include northern voices. Climate and biodiversity issues do not suddenly end or change when you hit Newry or Bleak.
On that point,
go.
Should they invite French citizens as well, or Spanish citizens, or American citizens, or people from other places, because it also doesn't stop outside the island?
Certainly, look, the climate is a global issue, but when it comes to this island, there is a need for joined up thinking on climate and biodiversity issues across this whole island as one place. Othering of people in Northern Ireland is a common experience felt by many. And it isn't just politics and civic spaces that Northern voices are absent. It's also in the media. Ireland's press ombudsman Susan McKay recently said that partition is very much reflected in the media in this country for a range of reasons. Some of them very understandable, some of them less so. Some of them more complicated and less well examined. How often do you hear a Northern voice on the radio or on the nightly news? And when they are on the air, how often is it about any other issue than the problems in Northern Ireland? And lest we forget the reporting around County Down man Patrick Kilty getting his post in RTE. How could he possibly interview the Taoiseach on taxes and rents if he is not living here? If he is not even resident in the country, they said. How could he be tuned into Irish affairs should he not be in the 26 counties? The partitioning of Ireland divided not only the region but the people, with the lived experiences of Irish citizens on both sides of the border entirely divergent through no more than an accident of birth. In the Republic, Irish citizens were free to develop a strong, independent Irish identity, while those born north of the border would go on to face decades of further oppression, violence, and denigration. To add insult to injury, Irish citizens in the north often faced that othering from their Irish counterparts in the Republic. The perception of people in the north as not quite Irish enough often rears its head when the notion of allowing Irish citizens in the north to participate in any of the democratic processes in the Republic of Ireland. When Green Party members in Northern Ireland had the opportunity to vote on the programme for government in the south, Senator David Norris wondered in a letter in the Irish Times if he was the only one who thinks it extraordinary that a group of 800 UK citizens from the north of Ireland who are members of the Green Party had the right to dictate that government we have in the Republic. Whilst columnist Ian O'Doherty once wrote quite confidently that he would never consider us Nordies to be as Irish as he is. Othering people in Northern Ireland is common and felt by many. I too experienced last year a civil servant who told me that I had no right to comment on the Irish Constitution because I was born in Northern Ireland. Being born or in Derry or Dublin does not make anyone more or less Irish. The driver for this disconnect is partition, which has created a disconnected island. In 2021, a Sunday Life opinion poll showed that 41% of respondents in the Republic of Ireland had never once crossed the border into the north. Nevertheless, we are told that people in the Republic truly care about Northern Ireland. And that evidence of that is the 94% yes vote for the Good Friday Agreement. Less talked about, however, is that the turnout in the Republic was only 56%. almost half of the electorate couldn't even bother to vote on peace in Northern Ireland. The turnout in Northern Ireland was 81%, with an estimated 180,000 non-voters who went out to vote because it was a seismic election. So I think the fact that people didn't turn out in their public actually shows more of a disinterest in Northern Affairs.
Or was it that it wasn't a foregone conclusion what way the North would vote, but that everyone down south absolutely accepted that it would be overwhelming in favour of the agreement?
Well, I look forward to you making that point. Looking to history, Northern Nationalists were left feeling alienated and abandoned by the Free State government when it agreed to the Boundary Commission's proposals in 1925. In exchange for accepting the Boundary Commission's report, which included increasing the territory of Northern Ireland, the Irish Free State was absolved of its share of the British national debt. The share under Article 5 of the Anglo-Irish Treaty was £10 million a year. The Free State purchased financial independence for the 26 counties at the expense of Irish unity. John Hume once famously remarked that the real division in Ireland is in the hearts and minds of its people. That's as evident today as it was before the Good Friday Agreement. The population has been conditioned to see Northern Ireland as lesser, as other, as separate since partition in 1921. And let's not get me started on Irish unity, for every one of the coalition party leaders has referred to constitutional change debates as divisive. The Irish Constitution includes legitimate aspiration to unite this island, but like so much else, that commitment is just words on a page, rarely read. I ask this House to vote for the motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and that's a fine nice patient. I much appreciate your work and effort into it. So we move on to Tom Burns.
It's a lot nicer than our Senate chamber, I'll be honest. Mr. Chair, Mr. President, Madam Auditor, our sponsor Ms. Hunter, members of the proposition, members of the HIST, and members of the House. I think after that I'm out of time. Let me take you back, if I may, to 2015. Just for a reminder, Uptown Funk is playing literally everywhere all of the time. Lin-Manuel Miranda jumped onto the world stage and then never left it ever again, no matter how hard we tried to get him to do so. And the black and blue dress haunted our every single waking moment, and it is black and blue, of which is on. In politics, Ed Miliband ate a bacon roll. Peter Robinson resigned as First Minister and the Republic legalised Kenman for a day. times. Now imagine in this past word we held this debate. Imagine that I, fresh-faced at 13, was asked to speak. I don't know why you'd do it, but anyway. Without a shadow of a doubt, I think I, at that age, and imagine maybe some of you who voted for this side of the House earlier on today, would be siding with Ms. D'Souza and her side. There was a very strong feeling, with arguably a very, very strong case to be made, that Ireland had forgotten about the North. Although, to be fair, that might have been an effect of the come down from the ecstasy that was also legalised at the same time. But the past, they say, is a different country entirely. The innocence and joy of 2015 came to a grinding halt about a year later. All of those good celebrities had died, Donald Trump and, of course, Brexit, leading to years of calamity and confusion, with Northern Ireland trapped in the middle of pretty much all of it. But thankfully, that's not really a problem anymore. No one ever talks about it, and everyone's been grand since. But other than that, it also led to levels of North-South engagement, the likes of which we had not seen since 1998. Ireland began again to actively partake in its role as co-guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement and of our peace, began to take an active interest in our interests, and became more and more involved in our lives day to day. But I'll admit, and I think it's kind of been alluded to in a sense, there is a fairly common feeling in the North of like being a child living with arguing parents. Let's take Ireland's the mother and Britain's the father. And neither of them want to talk to each other, and the house is really, really tense, and no one's really happy, and the wee child is left feeling sort of isolated and alone and uncared for and insignificant. But, I contest, nothing brings a child and its mother closer together than a father's midlife crisis. And in 2016, the UK did the equivalent of running off the young one buying a motorbike and decided to leave the European Union. And this, for me, is the turning point in the relationship between North and South. Ireland became inextricably linked to the Brexit process through border negotiations and the deal negotiations to protect its own internal market and its own sovereignty, to protect the European internal market and its sovereignty, and more importantly for us, to protect the people of Northern Ireland from a damaging no-deal Brexit that are on the very, very real risk of a return to violence here. with Ireland as a key voice and a prominent role in negotiations on the European end. We had someone fighting our corner and fighting for our interests with the heft and the quality to do so.
On that point?
Yeah, why not?
Was that not the point when the Irish government actually took a very positive interest in Northern Ireland and explicitly stand up on one side? And if you talk to UKIP, they probably would disagree with the position.
I think if you speak to Leave voters, they might maybe say that, not necessarily unionists, given that the Leave voters would. And, you know, Ireland took interest in Northern Ireland to protect violence. There are plenty of quotes if you would like them. Mr. Varadkar, 2019, the problem with a manned border in the context of Irish politics is that those things become targets, and we've seen that violence in the past. Plenty of speeches like that from Leave Varadkar at the Taoiseach at the time. I think if you ask Leave voters what they think, they'll not be best pleased, but everyone else maybe might have a different opinion. At the time, the significance of Irish citizenship and Irish identity in the North was under extreme pressure, and the engagement of the Irish government provided the strength to bolster it and ensure that it didn't fall entirely to the wayside. The Irish government was working for nationalists in Northern Ireland, they do say so, but they're also working for the majority of people in Northern Ireland who voted Remain in the referendum, and for everyone in Northern Ireland to ensure we did not see the return to violence in Ireland. And part of the reason they did this, I say, is as co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement, along with the UK government, Ireland's a co-signatory and a key partner in our peace process. But despite being co-guarantors, the roles aren't exactly like co-equal. Ireland doesn't have direct governance of the North because of partition. The roles aren't co-equal. They have no powers of taxation in the North. They have no cabinet ministers with a responsibility for the North. It falls under the Department of Foreign Affairs. It's a whole thing we could talk about another time. But as a constituent part of the UK, those powers reside in Westminster and in Whitehall. Their statutory involvement in the North comes from stands 2 and 3 of the Good Friday Agreement, which provides for cooperation in areas of mutual interest, as it says, but with no real sort of mandate for sort of government action. But nonetheless, since 2016, and no matter how much Mr. Sousa decides to deride it, they have set up their Shared Island Fund, promising a ring-fenced billion euros specifically for North-South collaboration and North development. From this, and through the North-South Ministerial Council set up under the GFA, for example, during COVID, ambulances were able to cross the border, getting to people north and south who needed them, saving countless lives, and I think showing Ireland's seriousness about health in the North. 56 million euro to the Meath campus in Derry, 70 million euro to the Climate Change Research Facility, the Narrowwater Bridge, the Men's Mental Health Sheds, the Rainbow Project, just yesterday, commitment on the A5 road between Derry and Auchnacloy. Sure.
Wait. The A5 commitment actually was a reinstatement of previous funding that they were actually meant to be under St Andrews and had withdrawn. So just to make the point that...
Yeah, but I mean, there's been years of inaction on the A5 road, but they've committed to providing more funding for it.
But
the point is there that they have provided the funding for it. They promised to provide the funding. The Department of Foreign Affairs... No, thanks. Sorry. Have included... No, thanks. Sorry. Their Department of Foreign Affairs have included Northern Ireland in their National Action Plan for the Women, Peace and Security Agenda, following years of systemic failure on behalf of the British government to have in place any kind of plan to tackle gender-based violence in Northern Ireland. That's the National Action Plan for the United Kingdom government, of which Northern Ireland is a part, has never mentioned Northern Ireland in its plan for peace and for women and for gender-based violence and for gender equality. Dublin's does. I'd ask what meaningful participation looks like, if not this. But perhaps the most significant way I think they've stood up for the North is by taking the UK government to court recently over the Legacy Act, an act which will halt inquests, trials and prosecutions that would give so many families closure and justice. And the Taoiseach noted the commitment made to victims and families as a key reason for taking this huge step. I think by doing this, we can see that Ireland have not forgotten about the North. They've not forgotten about our past. They've not forgotten about our victims or their families. They're standing by us. But I'll be honest, I think I can't disagree. The relationship between North and South hasn't always been rosy. It took nearly 40 years for a Taoiseach and a Northern Ireland Prime Minister to even meet. There are times when I have felt forgotten here before, but those days are no more. Through the 80s and the 90s, the likes of Fitzgerald, the late John Bruton, indeed our chair today, Mr. Hearn, saw the importance of the Republic as an active partner in Northern Irish affairs for the betterment of the people of Northern Ireland. And while we did lose that momentum for a while, we have seen since 2016 the many, many ways in which we are being prioritised once again. Through Brexit, through cross-border funding and policies, and through standing up for our victims. The story, however, is by no means finished. I think, Mr. Chair, there's a lot done, but more to do. I'm proud to vote.
Plenty of food to talk to the other side and throw up some good arguments. Sinead's coming.
the six counties, the north of Ireland, the place where Game of Thrones is filmed, Derry Girls, the part of the UK where there was some trouble for some years. I believe the minute the state of Northern Ireland emerged in May 1921, the Republic threw in the towel for the Nordics. Being from County Down, not Donegal, as 90% of people I've encountered in Dublin have guessed, I have first-hand experience of the Northern Irish state and its perception of the globe, or at least in Trinity. Some call us aggressive, others see us as troubled with a bit of baggage from the past. Many just think our accents are really fit. Once in college, someone seriously asked me if I fly up home, as though I'm on a different landmass or something, and was astonished at the fact that I'm only from an hour's drive away and I sound like this. Yet the most striking aspect of being in Dublin is the little knowledge the majority have regarding the North in its past. The troubles and its impact are severely underestimated, almost forgotten by the Southern Ireland populace. The forgotten past of the North only reflects the forgotten state which had, and obviously still has, so much political turbulence. The South seems to be blissfully unaware of the role it had in troubles, such as the Irish government ministers who organised the delivery of large amounts of weaponry to Republicans in 1969. They all love Derry Girls, but seem to forget the sincerity of the troubles and how finding someone on the run in your boot of the car would not be as funny as it seems, but rather terrifying. Having a father from Derry and a mother from Cork, I see a striking contrast between their respective childhoods. My mother seemed to lack any knowledge on the situation above the border, saying she was away down the country, so why would she? Well, my dad had encounters with the police as they checked his school bag to see if there was a bomb in it. Because indeed, a schoolboy would have a bomb in his bag sat on the floor at the bus stop. And the best thing to do when concerned about that is to kick the bomb-filled bag. Or the time he played an under-14 match and was rudely interrupted by the British Army prancing across the field of young teens trying to play a bit of ball. This stark difference is representative of the gap of knowledge the South seemed to have about the North and the island's history with regards to partition. While working in a pub in Dublin recently, I began serving what can only be described as a D4 college student to his core. As he ordered three Sambuca off me, the first thing he said to me was, English? 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 I'm sorry, but throwing assumptions out like that after hearing me say, would you like something to drink, is absolutely wild. Just rub salt in the wound that is being in the forgotten six counties. Studying Irish history in school gave me more insight than I would have received otherwise regarding our past and our partition came to be. Yet it seems as though many receive some level of education regarding the subject and simply just don't care. When I heard Stormont was finally back and running after lying dormant for years, I felt so much hope that finally the North would have a real chance for some strong political representation directly from those we elected. I was so glad, I told some of my Southern friends, and the response I got was, what a Stormont. Another clear example of how the North is like a cup of tea you forgot about, just to the South, lukewarm and sitting in the corner, neglected and unappreciated. Don't get me wrong, I love the Republic. I chose to leave the North to pursue my degree in a vibrant and diverse city. Seeing South Dublin Trinity students in the flesh and taking the Lewis to class is brilliant. It's no glamour though. I just don't like how the Southerners think they're sort of quirky and different in many respects when we are far more alike than we realise. We both love pints, we love the crack, and we both have major mistrusts in our own governments. While there are different perceptions of Sinn Féin in the North and South, Sinn Féin is growing, a fast-growing and very successful party, both sides of the border. Basically, the South really shouldn't try to be so nonchalant and cool about the North, since we are far more like them than they think. We are more than just a city rigged to Belfast, or a trip to the Giant's Causeway. We are more than a few successful TV shows and a stable, unstable political climate. I just wish Southerners weren't more shocked at how I say the word her than the fact that Stormont has been inactive for more than a third of its lifespan. What really brings it home is the fact that Northerners can't even enter the late show competitions, yet the host is literally from Down, mind you, 20 minutes down the road from me. Imagine the upset as I miss out on a chance to win trips to New York and bucket loads of cash, only to be told no, because I'm from above the border. That is blatant discrimination. Sometimes I wonder if the Southerners believe the North actually exists, that it isn't just a made-up state with people who have funny accents and like to scrap. An Irish Times study from February 2023 has a headline. Southerners think Northern Ireland is as foreign as Siberia. Siberia. The study showed two-thirds of people of the Republic said they have no friends in the North. So if I consider myself to have about, I'd say, like six friends in college, that means four of them just don't actually like me. That's just me. In comparison, only half of Northerners say they have friends in the South. I'm seriously reconsidering how reciprocated my friendships are in college right now.
On that point,
your kind of speech is kind of focusing on the idea that a lot of southerners aren't really concerned with the day-to-day going on in the north, but if I was to get anyone like from the street and say that, here, what's your opinion on current employment in Dublin, or about farmers and Kerry or Cork and what their concerns are, they're probably not going to be thinking about it very much. Just saying the general vibe doesn't mean the south has forgotten us, it just means that people in their day-to-day life don't spend all their time wondering about what's going on in the six counties. I mean, the argument seems to be just there's a general vibe rather than the actuality of politics and government.
I hear what you're saying. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. But I just feel, I'm just saying from my own personal experience, I perceive this debate as to be southerners or northerners are forgotten by the south. And I feel forgotten. How I'm sometimes treated in the Dublin, I feel forgotten. I know that you can go deeper and like get all these statistics and get this political things inside. When you look at its core and how I felt like I've been perceived in the north, this is how I've been perceived, you know? Back to this, sorry, lost my point here. More than 80% said they have no relations here. Again, I feel many are lying. They're like the opposite of Americans with regards to the north, cutting all ties with us. More than half have not travelled across the border in the past 5 years. Considering the price of drink and coffee in Dublin, they're really missing the mark with that one. Imagine, the majority have never experienced an £8 double vodka or £3.50 meal deal from Tesco. If anything brings southerners to the north, it must be the idea that you don't spend your family fortune on a night out, or that you can get a half-decent fee for less than a tenner. If the study's figures aren't proof of arrogance and a lack of interest in the six counties of the north, I don't know what is. I may be biased, but figures do not lie. Ultimately, the discourse regarding the north needs to improve in the south. We can't forget the many brilliant northerners, such as poet James Heaney, Nobel Peace Prize winner John Hume, and Michelle O'Neill, just to name a few. At the end of the day, we share the same land. We may be separated by an invisible border, but that does not mean our southern counterparts should see this as a wall, something to stop them from learning about and engaging with the north. After all, a referendum for Irish unity could be just around the corner, whether you like it or not. We just want a bit more attention, some TLC from the rest of the Emerald Isle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nate.
Thank you.
Now, a person who did a lot of work and worked very hard to try and make sure everybody was listening to what was going on in the North, Ian.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for the invitation to join you here tonight. So the motion of this House is that the Republic of Ireland has forgotten Northern Ireland. So could the Republic forget Northern Ireland? Well, you can forget your birthday, you can forget your glasses, you can probably forget your car keys, but you could actually forget something that you're part of, connected to, and integrated with. I wonder, could you forget your arm or your leg? Could you forget how to breathe? I don't think so. But so to consider, let's understand what we mean by forgotten. If you look up forgotten, it'll tell you in the dictionary that it's deserted, abandoned, rejected, neglected, ignored, discarded, or cast off. Really? Is that the relationship between North and South? So I think to understand the relationship, we need to go back to 1921. We need to go back to a time of civil unrest and a time of difference and division, where agreement was reached in London to deliver an accommodation and a settlement on the island in the form of partition, considered at the time as a temporary agreed solution until such time as differences could be resolved. So at this point we had forced separation, with a managed division and a drawing a line on the map on the birth of two separate jurisdictions, governed separately, separate currencies, separate taxation, separate rules and regulations, but with one cohort of citizens separated only by religion and political ideals. Indeed, something I've often thought about is that when we consider partition, I don't actually think unionists and loyalists have ever got the hurt the partition created in Narcissist and Republican communities. And on that matter, I don't think that Narcissists and Republicans have actually truly understood the connection that Northern unionists and loyalists have to the British state. So there we had it, separated, but still connected. So could the Republic forget the North? Well, to answer the question, we need to understand some context following partition and the onset of the conflict as it became known. The Republic of Ireland officially took a hands-off approach to the conflict in Northern Ireland, viewed it as an internal matter for the UK. However, there was sympathy among many people in the Irish public for the plight of Northern Ireland. The Irish government did make some diplomatic efforts to encourage a peaceful resolution, such as calling for power sharing and reconciliation. However, they were limited in influence over UK policy in Northern Ireland. There are also allegations that some Irish security forces turning a blind eye to IRA attacks launched from the Republic into Northern Ireland, even some evidence of collusion. Even though successive Irish governments denied actively supporting the IRA, they were still accused of not doing enough to stop cross-border attacks. They're also accused of harbouring individuals fleeing violence, despite some extradition of suspected IRA volunteers back to Northern Ireland to face charges. Moving on, after the 1985 Anglo-Irish Agreement, the Irish government was given a consultative role in Northern Ireland affairs. This marked an increased Irish diplomatic involvement in seeking settlement to what went on north of the border. And by the time we arrive at 1998 on the Good Friday Agreement, created a formal cross-border body, were created formal cross-border bodies to encourage cooperation between Northern Ireland and the Republic on issues like trade and business. Indeed, there are ongoing political and cultural ties between Northern Ireland and the Republic, with the Northern Ireland Assembly and Irish Parliament both recognising the importance of North-South cooperation on matters of mutual interest. While historic tension remains, it will be oversimplification to say that the Republic of Ireland has forgotten Northern Ireland. The relationship is complex, but efforts have been made to increase cooperation and understanding between the two. So let's consider some of the organisations across the island. Under the direction of the North South Ministerial Council, we have six implementation bodies: Waterways Ireland, Food Safety Promotion Board, Intertrade Ireland, Special EU Programme Body, the Language Body, Foy Carrigford and Irish Lights Commission. If we consider the health sector, we have an extensive collaboration with the All Ireland Cancer Research Institute, collaboration between a large number of organisations North and South, Queen's, UU, Belfast Health Trust, the Western Trust, in Northern Ireland, and UCD, UCC, Limerick and Galway, in the Republic. Entities, with extensive cooperation between health provision North and South, as we attempt to drive good primary health care, address the waiting lists, and delivery of long overdue surgical procedures for many. If we look at education, we have a fantastic cooperation between our universities across the island and across many of our campuses. Indeed, when Brexit took hold and the UK was trailed out of the Erasmus programme, where 10,000 students were going to Europe and 30,000 students coming back to study in the UK annually, something was replaced by the Turing programme. The universities in the Republic actually stood up to the mark, and they're providing access to Northern Ireland students into Erasmus. However, unfortunately, it doesn't address the issue of getting international students back into here, into Belfast. Let's not forget tourism. We've got Tourism Ireland, and they promote tourism and leisure across the entire island, bringing together Fáilte Ireland and Tourism Northern Ireland to support, develop and grow visitor numbers to north and south of the island. What about the agri-food industry? The sector built on trade across the entire island, and for that matter between two islands, wholly dependent on the number of businesses and organisations working across both jurisdictions, buying, selling, processing, and in a symbiotic relationship where all benefit from harmonisation and cooperation. Businesses like Dale Farm, Lakeland, Glanbia, ABP, Dunbia, Dawn Meats, Moy Park, Fianna Valley, all focused on development and growth across the entire island. And lastly, let's look at sports across the island. Now, you might be forgiven for thinking that due to a distinct lack of Ulster men on the Irish rugby team at the moment, they have actually forgotten about us. But I think this is temporary. I hope it's temporary due to poor form and a strong squad to choose from. And fingers crossed the form improves and we get more Northerners back on the national squad. However, sport is actually a really good example of cooperation within and across the island, because there's at least 32 all-island sporting governing bodies. Sports such as athletics, badminton, baseball, canoeing, cricket, cycling, GAA, golf, hockey, handball, horse racing, mountaineering, rowing, tennis, squash, swimming, the list goes on, all with all-island governing bodies. So what about the Irish government? As we mentioned earlier, shared island units was mentioned. Part of a department of the Taoiseach set up to examine political, social, economic and cultural considerations of a shared future for all communities and traditions in the island underpinned the Good Friday Agreement. Announced in 2021 with a budget of £500 million in capital funding available between 2021 and 2025. It's ring-fenced for investment in collaborative North-South projects across a number of capital projects: research, tourism, business, community, youth development, civic engagement, arts, culture, infrastructure, enterprise, education, biodiversity, environment and rail transport. The Shared Ireland Initiative involves working with the Northern Ireland Executive and the British Government to address strategic challenges faced on the island of Ireland. It involves further developing the economy across the island, deepening North-South cooperation and investing in the North-Western border regions. It involves fostering constructive and inclusive dialogue and comprehensive programme of research to support the building of consensus around a shared future on the island. Shared Island Unit is in the part of the Taoiseach, acts as a driver and a coordinator of this whole of government initiative. So does this all point to the Republic forgetting Northern Ireland? I would suggest to this House it doesn't. That's not to say that I don't believe the Republic at times turned a blind eye, at times chose not to see, at times made a conscious decision not to assist, at times even had an attitude of just looking after their own interests. But that's actually more about normal relationships between two neighbouring countries and doing what's best for themselves. It certainly can't be considered as forgetting about Northern Ireland. And on many occasions I've watched with interest where politicians south of the border engaged with the North only when there was political expediency or some political capital to gain. And if there wasn't, turning a blind eye and looking the other way when there was nothing in it for them. But sure, isn't that what we do in Northern Ireland? And what about the people? Do we think the people have forgotten about Northern Ireland? Well, I don't. And I think many people south of the border have actually got very limited interest or, for that matter, understanding of Northern Ireland. Now, based on my own experience in the Seanad, and remember, I was elected representative in the Seanad, and I was an Ordie from the Black North, as people keep reminding me. And many in the Republic, especially in the southern half of the country, know very little about us. They even know very little about us, but they even care very little about Northern Ireland because of lack of engagement. Many have never actually visited Northern Ireland. But that doesn't mean they've forgotten us. I certainly don't think it does. I think it's a case that rather than forgetting us, they've never actually got to know us, and they don't understand much about us. And quite often, it's knowledge based on news snippets from Northern Ireland news or it's second or third hand information. So maybe we need to invite more people to visit Northern Ireland, to understand us, to build friendships, to do business, partake in culture, arts and leisure, and generally get to know us. As indeed, we need more people to visit the Republic to better understand them. Members of the HIST, members of the Literific, ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, I'd like to ask you to think long and hard about the motion proposed this evening. Some self-reflection is necessary this evening. We don't need self-pity. We don't need insecurity, and we need to stop feeling sorry for ourselves. The Republic of Ireland have forgotten us no more than we have forgotten them. I'll leave it to you to consider if Northern Ireland has been, remember, deserted, abandoned, rejected, neglected, ignored, discarded, or cast off. I think not. And certainly not forgotten. And for this reason, I urge you to oppose this motion.
Good afternoon, members of the House, if it is still afternoon, I'm actually not sure what time it is. I have time travelled back to Northern Ireland in the 1970s, to a time where violence was rampant, to a time where parties had done away with civil rights, to a time where British soldiers roamed the streets and Catholics and Protestants were kept away from each other. I have time travelled back to Northern Ireland in the 1970s, and you all can too, because there are just two steps to doing so. Step one, go down south. Step two, ask someone from down south what they think the current political situation is in Northern Ireland. And during that conversation, you'll be transported to an outdated, inaccurate view of Northern Ireland and the people living in it. I've been told I live in a quagmire. I've been asked if I pledge allegiance to the King and warned that my unionist friends and neighbours want to burn me out of house and home for supporting a united Ireland. The Republic remembers a stereotype of what Northern Ireland used to be. They don't ever stop to think about the current reality of Northern Ireland, how they could be working together more on the shared island and should be preparing for the inevitability that is a united Ireland. Any political gestures or coordination between the two is token and does not function well. You cannot define doing the bare minimum sometimes as remembering and the 1 billion figure, no thank you, and the 1 billion figure that Tom said earlier, that's still less than 1% of the annual budget of the South. It's not exactly a large number to give to six of the 32 counties. The Republic has forgotten the North, and to demonstrate this, we must first look at the 26 counties, a little known place called Donegal. Donegal. I warned you. Donegal has been continually neglected by the Republic. Its own politicians have labelled it the forgotten county because it is ignored by the Irish government even in times of crisis. Donegal faces a shocking lack of connectivity to the rest of the Republic. They can't get the funding to build a pedestrian crossing, never mind a railway. The Republic has neglected to give Donegal funding for their housing crisis, for broadband rollout, and most of all for healthcare provision.
On a point of information,
yes, please.
There is a universal rollout of fibre broadband right throughout the 26 county station, and it will cover every house, including Donegal.
Brilliant. Yay. Still not remembering Northern Ireland. The Republic has neglected to give 78 Donegal GPs in the last year wrote to the government raising concerns for patient safety at a Letterkenny hospital, and the government did nothing. And this isn't just Donegal that is forgotten. The same could be said for Monaghan and Cavan, for Leash and Mayo. If you aren't Dublin in the Republic, you're forgotten. The South has forgotten its own counties, so why would it remember Northern Ireland? Dublin really only seems to care and think about itself. If this was a play, Dublin would be doing its one-man monologue while the other 25 counties are forgettable side characters kind of dancing around, and Northern Ireland is kept backstage the entire time. This is because the Republic has a problem with centralisation. It is one of the most centralised states in Europe. Everything takes place in Dublin. 95% of tax revenue comes from central government, and 93% of local spending is dispersed by them. The centralisation of power and finances within Dublin has left the other 25 counties feeling forgotten as they deal with rural depopulation and community decline. If the Republic can't remember that it's 25 other counties than Dublin, then it has definitely forgotten the same counties in the same way that London has forgotten us. And it's a strange comparison, considering the Republic's desire to be independent and separate itself from the United Kingdom. But London and Dublin mirror each other. Both are bustling, prosperous international cities, both are centres of business and administrative capitals, and much like London does not look past the southeast of England, Dublin does not look far beyond the Peel. Northern Ireland is continually forgotten by those who are meant to care about it the most. The opposition can point out small acts of service the Republic has done for the North, but none of us have felt any of that good. The Republic could help improve connectivity, could make it easier for people to work and go to university across the border, maybe even teach about the troubles in their schools.
On that point.
I'll take Thomas.
They have done those things. They have in the past sort of few months made it easier for people to go to university in the North, and they have helped build roads. They're committing to the A5, a recommitment to the A5.
Yeah, but actually, the A5 is actually more about trying to get connectivity to places like Donegal. It doesn't just benefit the North. These are things that should have been around a lot longer, just because you're doing it now and we're not really feeling it. Like, I haven't, like, on the point of university, like, even just researching about trying to go to university in somewhere like Galway or Dublin, it's super expensive for anyone from the North, and also the grades are absolutely insane to get in because they up them for people from Northern Ireland. I don't really feel like anyone from Northern Ireland feels any of that good, and I don't think that it has been done soon enough, and I do think because of that we feel forgotten. I feel like the Republic would rather just forget Northern Ireland until the day a border poll comes around and they begrudgingly have to take us on. No, thank you. More forgotten than anyone by the Republic is the unionist population of Northern Ireland. The Republic chooses to remember a gross misrepresentation of the unionist people as primitive and violent. I have never been more ashamed of Ireland than I have been when listening to so-called educated Dubliners speak about unionists, as if they are all old members of the Orange Order, beating their drums and shouting, "I don't care what type of poverty I live in, as long as it is red, white and blue poverty." The Republic treats unionists like exhibits in a museum from long ago, instead of like real living people who need to be remembered in politics today. They deliberately have forgotten the need to accept and cooperate with the unionists. Parties in the Republic talk about them, around them, behind their backs, but they don't talk to them. No, thank you. We cannot say that the Republic has remembered Northern Ireland when it deliberately forgets the largest minority on this island and almost half of Northern Ireland. The Republic has an issue. Dublin has put all the focus on itself, leaving hardly any attention for the other 25 counties and nothing left for Northern Ireland. Counties like Donegal are neglected, Northern Ireland is an afterthought at most, and unionists are deliberately forgotten. Dublin is just another London that forgets the common people it cannot profit from and forgets the people of Northern Ireland. So I hope for all our future sake that Dublin starts to remember so that the other 25 counties and the 6 counties can finally feel some of the good the opposition have spoke about. Thank you.
The motion is that this House believes the Republic has forgotten Northern Ireland. Now, our role on this side is to prove that on balance, not as an absolute, yes, there were moments of neglect, but on balance, that the Republic has not forgotten Northern Ireland. And I hope that we'll be able to establish that. And that in fact the reality was that the South kept making approaches to Northern Ireland over the years, and particularly in the early years, got rejected time and time again. It was like a lover that kept coming, but kept getting rejected. And you have to go back to the beginning. If you look at the Government of Ireland Act, 1920, and then the treaty, there was meant to be a Council of Ireland, and the idea was that representatives north and south would meet and that they would discuss matters of common interest in the island, because even the British government recognised that this is one island. Who rejected it? The South or the North? I think you know the answer. There's a picture outside here, representative of South Down, who came to Northern Ireland in the mid-20s and was immediately ejected, came back in having gone to County Down first, into Derry, and immediately got arrested, and always claimed that the worst food in any prison he ever got was in the Crumlin Road in Belfast. That person came back and was elected to Stormont between 1933 and 38, when he was Taoiseach in the Republic. The interesting thing is that if you look at the first government of Fianna Fáil, 3 of the 10 members actually came from Northern Ireland. Joe Connolly, Sean McEntee, and Frank Aiken. And the South did make interventions and positive interventions, even though every time it came it was being rejected. And one of the very significant interventions was to argue very strongly with the British government that conscription should not be applied to Northern Ireland during the Second World War. And the only people who were not subject to conscription to the British Army from the United Kingdom were the people in Northern Ireland. Furthermore, during the Blitz, when Belfast was bombed, the fire engines were sent from Dundalk, Drogheda, Balbriggan and Dublin to come to the aid of the people of Belfast. Now the interesting thing is that eventually Northern Ireland realised under the premiership, and this was a prime minister here, these chambers had a House of Commons and a Senate, and Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, Terence O'Neill, realised, he was a Unionist Prime Minister, realised that it was time for the two sides to get together. The Taoiseach came north, he went south, he visited the President. But the reality was that all he got for his troubles was total rejection, and he lost the seat eventually in North Antrim. So the reality was that when dialogue was tried, they kept getting refused, but in fairness, we kept coming, despite constant rejection. Yes?
Wasn't it during that scene that he had been involved in a circle on bombs to the Iron Man? Isn't it fair that some of the Northern rejected Southern ministers?
Well, the reality was that they actually didn't ever run the guns. They never got there. There has been a huge change. And the most significant change in my lifetime was the change of attitude of the Reverend Ian Paisley. And without embarrassing the chair, I think it's fair to say he had a big part in it. But there's still work to be done. The reality is that there are provisions in the Good Friday Agreement that would supersede anything you've suggested in relation to the Senate, in relation to having a North-South Parliamentary Assembly. There was meant to be citizens' assemblies. There were meant to be a lot more North-South bodies, but that again was rejected. So we have to work on all of these things. Because I believe, for example, a parliamentary assembly that would be, you know, 20 or 30 on each side would be much more powerful than three senators north, down south, talking about southern affairs most of the time. So my thesis is that the reality is that there have been constant efforts by the south to engage, that the problem had been historically, but that is beginning to wane, that there was a fear of engaging from the unionist community in the North-South, and that the nationalist community felt forgotten about by both sides. We have a lot of work to do, but what I would say is, we haven't forgotten Northern Ireland. I think it's fair to say that within my own lifetime, I have spent an inordinate amount of political time engaged in issues up here in relation to prisoners, getting to know people in the unionist community, etc. And what I would also say is, thankfully, things have changed. And the reality is now that slowly but surely, the lover that was spurned is now been embraced. And we hope there'll be a lot more of that in the future. Good to meet you, Michael.
Speaker, thanks for having us here today.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Dr. Steve Aiken.
Cheers.
It's an interesting proposition. And when I looked and see my good friend Ian Marshall on the other side of the room, it brings me back. And Ian, I hope you don't mind me saying this, because when I was the leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, I tried at that time to get Ian to come and join our party. And the interesting thing is, he wouldn't do it for me. He did it for Doug, but wouldn't do it for me. And the thing he said to me was, Steve, here's the thing. I want to get back in the Senate because I think that's something I can really contribute. And I said, sort of, Ian, with my experience and what I've learnt and what I know, because I've been involved in all these North-South dialogues and all the rest of it. He says, no, you won't. He don't want you. Because what will happen is the seat will go to somebody else to deal with some kind of Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael stitch-up that happens. And that's what exactly happened. And somebody like me, who has made a real effort over the years to build North-South dialogue, I sit on every alphabet soup of British-Irish Parliamentary Assembly. I used to be on the British-Irish Association. I was the founding chief executive of the British-Irish Chamber of Commerce. But the one common theme that always ran through it is that if you were in Dublin and you thought about the United Kingdom, you looked east. Embarrassingly, also in London, if you talked about the European Union, you also looked east. So basically, nobody in London paid any attention to the Irish Republic, and nobody in the Irish Republic paid any attention to the other part of the United Kingdom that's attached to their island.
Point.
Certainly.
If you're saying if you were in Dublin and you looked east to think of the United Kingdom, would that not imply that the Irish Republic viewed north as part of Ireland and something that mattered an awful lot to them?
Nope. Absolutely not. We heard a couple of classic examples. We heard this really good thing about the sort of shared island fund, the billion euros. I was the chair of the finance committee until fairly recently, and we had the finance meeting yesterday. So one of the questions we asked is, how much of that money have we actually seen? How much of the money do we actually see for the A5? Anybody care to give a guess? Anybody like to tell how many euros have gone across? Absolutely nothing. How much money has gone to this? Sir, no, you're not getting in again. You not in my chamber, sunshine. On that point, when we look at how much money has actually gone towards the shared medical campus being developed in Londonderry, anybody care for a guess how much money has actually come across? Zero. Absolutely nothing. It wasn't so long ago, I was sitting on a platform, and it was in Brussels, and there was a senior Irish minister there, and we were talking about relationships across the island. And, you know, I'm a fairly quiet unionist. No, I'm not, but I said that anyway. I was sitting in the platform, and this particular Irish commissioner, EU commissioner, spent a lot of time telling everybody what people in Northern Ireland were thinking. And in particular, what unionists were thinking. Which I thought was quite surprising, because there was actually a unionist who was sitting on that platform, and never once did they turn around and say, Steve, what do you think? And I thought that was just because I'm a unionist. And then I had a very good friend of mine from the SDLP was sitting right beside, and exactly the same thing happened. We're not thought about. People in Dublin don't think about us. Now, I have to give a corollary here. I've got a very good friend, this might sound strange, Sean Crowe is a very good friend of mine, who's a quite famous Sinn Féin politician. But he said, Steve, I wouldn't worry about it, because I come from Tala, nobody in Dublin gives a damn about us in Tala. And there's a lot about that, because, you know, I spend a lot of time in Dublin, and I definitely get the sense that if there's anything outside the M50, people don't give a monkey's. And, you know, it's an all-island problem, because of the elites who sit in Dublin, sit in the Dáil, and those who sit in the various government offices there, they don't actually care very much about anything that happens outside the M50. And in some respects, it might go slightly against the proposition. You know, nobody in Dublin really cares about Northern Ireland. But actually, I don't actually think there's many people in Dublin care very much what happens outside Dublin, or indeed what happens in Dublin. I used to be the chief executive at Dublin City University, North Dublin. People would wander around thinking, I might as well have been a Nordic if I said I was from North Dublin. It was nearly as bad. And when you look at the housing crisis and the issues that are running there at the moment, you know, there's a real issue here in politics on this island. We've got problems here. People in the south, you've got huge problems that you're going to have to deal with. Because if we're in a situation where people can't get housing, can't get affordable healthcare for their kids, can't afford to get their bins cleared, can't get private healthcare, all those things together just demonstrate that not only is there no interest in the Republic of Ireland in Northern Ireland, there isn't much interest in the Republic of Ireland in the rest of the Republic of Ireland either. And that's something we're going to have to fix. And I think those are sort of really significant problems. But to go back, and I'm going to say this, and I'm going to make this part of political speech now because the leader of the SDLP has just walked in. Hi, Colin. How are you? Oh, I know, I thought you might. The thing that I want to do, and I want to reach out, and this might sound as strange as a unionist. I believe passionately in Northern Ireland remaining part of the United Kingdom, which I think it will, for the foreseeable future and beyond. But the real issue for me is that I want to see this island work and work effectively. You know, I want to see a proper all-island rail strategy. I want to be in a situation where I can get on a train in Londonderry and actually be in Cork 3 hours later. Not get on a train in Londonderry, stop in Belfast that's missed a connection to Dublin by 15 minutes. Bizarrely, even now. I want to be in a situation that we have an all-island energy strategy, because the climate emergency is the biggest thing that's going to impact all of us on this island and these islands and Europe and beyond. We need to be able to fix that. And we've got to be able to do that by working together. But I reach out this hand, speaking as somebody who is a unionist, passionate about the union. I reach out this hand to Dublin and to the Irish political spectrum and everybody in the Republic of Ireland. I reach out this hand of friendship. We need to understand each other better. We need to share this island and these islands to make it all work and work, make it work effectively. Because I think we can do that. But until we do that, until we recognise that we can't ignore each other. And I think somebody said, you know, I used to regularly go and walk sort of through the Doyle. And I used to enjoy going through the Doyle for two reasons. And the first one is, this is a little known fact, that as an MLA, I actually get a parking space in Dublin that's free. Brilliant, that. And the second one, it's got a really good restaurant, which I can go and eat in, which is reasonably cheap, and you don't pay the rest of the Dublin prices to go there. But more importantly, you got to meet people and talk to people. But all that stopped when Leo Varadkar became the Taoiseach and Simon Coveney became head of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. An entire relationship ended, North and South. And whether it was Brexit effect or whatever it happens to be, we reached a situation where that dialogue had stopped. And as I said, I'm a member of the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly, and one of the things I did to try and reach out was to try and get that dialogue moving again, because it's not healthy for anybody in these islands. But speaking as somebody who is a practitioner, the proposition is very clear. On this island, we should be working closely together. For those in the opposition, I can tell you right now, we're not. We need to fix it. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Steve. So, our last speaker, Sebastian.
Chair, audience, members of the proposition, fellow members of the opposition. I think it's fair to say that United Ireland has long been a dream of a great many Irish people, regardless of how you may feel about that prospect. I think the problem is that successive governments of the Republic of Ireland have failed their people repeatedly, leading to a relative state of decay, a decay which has yanked us back to our daily realities and pushed thoughts of Northern Ireland to the dark recesses of the mind. But there they remain, nevertheless, waiting to be brought to the fore once more. I want to go over two things before I get into my speech proper. I'll be taking a bit of a different tack, I think, than most of the individuals on my bench, who I think have mostly dealt with the policy questions and have been like well contested by the proposition. I contend that the Republic is not her state, but the people within it. And I think that most, or if not everyone here, would not consider their government to be a perfect representative of their interests, even those who are involved within governments, north or south. That's just not how democracy works. I'll come back to this a bit more later, why I think that the people do feel differently en masse. But I'd also like to first remind you that standing for the opposition doesn't mean we have to stand for the Republic doing a good job of these things. And I have to say, I think I would probably agree with many of the points raised that it's not. I think we've heard that they are certainly doing some things, but I would certainly agree that they can be doing a whole lot more, as we've heard. I think we can also probably agree that there's an astonishing lack of education about the North in the South. I wouldn't like for us all to be judged by the brush of D4 boys, who are not exactly the most educated on any social issue, I'd say. I think it's also appalling that the Irish government tried to drop history as a mandatory subject recently in second level. It's clearly a big issue that like these topics aren't being talked enough and aren't being taught enough. But equally, I don't think that's representative of everyone. And I think there's a lot of people with a keen interest. And I think as we've heard already, especially in the last couple of speeches, there's some clear neglect across the island. not just in the north, from the government. I'm from Wicklow, I'm literally just south of Dublin, and half the time they seem to decide to just cancel the trains because they don't really want us there anymore. If you can't get somewhere on the train, then you have to take about 17 different buses to maybe get where you're going after like 4 hours. So it's not exactly a great system outside of the pale, but I wouldn't say that they've precisely forgotten us either, because we still have representation, we still have discussions, and we still engage. It's just obviously very centralized in Dublin. Okay, so what is my case for why it's not forgotten, but potentially pushed back? I think that there's quite a problem currently in the South, as there are in actually a lot of countries around the world, in that there are simply just a lot of crises ongoing at the moment. I don't think anyone's going to contest that. The environment is kind of in a massive state of disaster. There's a homelessness epidemic in the Republic as well as in many other places. There are so many people who are at risk of homelessness there, who are tirelessly working to make ends meet, and many young people can't even conceive of the idea of potentially owning a home or a flat like some of their parents might have. Similarly, the public health service, as has been pointed out previously, is not exactly doing well, and there are many people left without like life-changing surgeries and therapies which would make their lives much better for them. It has some of the worst social inequality in the EU, as I found out preparing for this debate, with nearly 20% of people on or below the poverty line, including 1 in 5 children. Fairly shocking, but I think they can also be considered pretty reasonable mitigating factors for why, you know, many of these individuals might not be consciously discussing the North at every single time, but it's still something they care about. And I think, again, if you move out of kind of the specific sphere, the specific default sphere that we've heard, which I'll admit is not the best place for discourse, both through my time in the HIST and my time in school, I think that you'll find that if you actually, like, having conversations with people, especially where I'm from, like, I'm just in a small town, but still quite a lot of the people I would have gone to school with would have taken subjects like history and politics, even though they're optional, would have had, like, strong opinions and been willing to have discussions about places like the North. I think there's a lot more care about it. Often when I talk to my parents and my grandparents in the older generations, but also in the younger generations, too. I think it's probably, in my opinion and from my experience of talking to many people in both Dublin and beyond, I think it can be seen that rather plain and simple, that the Republic has not actually like forgotten about the North. I think it's something that can be brought up and brought to their minds quite easily. I think we see this in quite a few ways. I think the most obvious being that people simply just have friends and family north and south of the border. There are many people from the North who come down to study in southern universities and vice versa. I know people who are studying in Queens right now from where I grew up. I also have some of my best friends who have come down from the North to study in Trinity. The rugby has been brought up already, but I do think it's an especially nice institution that we come together for what is, though maybe not technically the national sport, a sport that certainly most people on both sides of the border greatly appreciate and work together on. And I think that we travel up and down for events and debates like this. This is not the first time that the College Historical Society has been up to Belfast. This is the first time, I think, in this chamber, which is much nicer. It's also not the first time that the Literific has like debated against us, and indeed they have come down to Dublin multiple times. I think the fact that these events like this even exist in the first place is a pretty strong indication that this is something that many students actively want to do, as we can see by the number of people in this room. I also think that, as we've already heard with Brexit, and most recently the amount of attention and effort paid both by, to some extent, the government, but also the broader people of the Republic into the Windsor framework, that the economies are inextricably interlinked. And I think it's kind of you don't know what you've got till it's gone type of vibes, where I think a lot of people in the South didn't necessarily ever think that the North no longer being accessible or that special relationship changing would ever happen to them. And Brexit really kind of reminded people that it's something they need to pay a lot more attention for and fight for, which I think is why there's been a lot of, not just attention when Brexit originally happened, but continuous attention over the last decade or so, which seems to be continuing to go on into the future. I think it's reasonable, and most people agree, that our brains only have so much space in them. It's only natural that individuals under assault by like a large range of life-affecting problems and issues would be more immediately preoccupied by them than others. I think it's important to remember, though, that just like many other priorities, many people in the South and our government repeatedly come back to the questions of North-South relations and do give them the careful consideration that they deserve. It may be the case that the subject needs more attention and discussion, and I definitely agree that it does, but that will need a better response to our current plights and situation from our state. I don't think, however, that it means that the North has actually been forgotten, and I'm very proud to oppose. Thank you.
To your audience, your decision now, but I want to thank Emma, Sinead, Fabian, Steve, Tom, Ian, Eamon, Sebastian for a very lively debate. I have to thank them for exchanging the views. I'm not going to give you my views until after the vote, so I'm not going to influence anything. But I think it's been very interesting for to listen to the debate. I'll say a few words afterwards, and I couldn't get involved in current day battles, but say a few things afterwards. But anyway, let's put the question. I now put the question to the House on the motion. This House believes the Republic has forgotten Northern Ireland, so all those in favour, hands up. Okay, those against. Better take the abstentions just in case the people that call them. They're abstaining on the facility. Motion is carried. End this and we can say a few words, but then thanks to the two colleges for everyone participating, and I do hope, I know you've had debates like this before in Dublin and Belfast, but I think it's good that we'll be here, and hopefully that'll happen and continue into the years ahead. I wish the students every success. I always, from the time I used to be on Saturday nights, life was different, Eamon, in our day. The hiss was in Erdsford Terrace at 7 o'clock on a Saturday night. Nowadays you wouldn't find a student in Dublin on a Saturday night. They're all gone to the Four Corners, but in those days that's when it was. My memories were always of afterwards in various pubs around town, but anyway, they were good days and good times. I want to say it's great to meet up with Ian again and Steve and thank them for their contributions. Eamon and I battled long and hard for decades and decades. Just say a few points, very interesting for me to listen to debate, and obviously I'm not involved in day-to-day politics anymore, but I've always had an interest in Northern Ireland. My first from a house that was probably political, not only was involved in politics, I was the first to be elected to anything, but the first time I really got what the border meant and what partition meant was when Down won the 1960 football final. 50,000 people travelled from Down and surrounded areas to support them in Dublin. Nowadays Dublin get 15,000 tickets for matches, but the discrimination against Dublin never stops. from Dublin, which it's a sad fact that all the civil service are from around the country. Most parliamentarians, if they're even elected for Dublin, are from the country. Usually the Garda Commissioner of probably from Northern Ireland, or head of the army is probably from border regions, and we don't hold much power in Dublin. We're very much difficult, even on All-Ireland Final Day, you travel across the city, and you only see a few Dublin flags because they're all from the country. So it is very difficult. So it's very interesting to listen to people, what you think, what we think of the rest of the country. But it's a bit difficult for people because they're all from the rest of the country. Most of our people now have to live in Loud and in Neave and Cavan and everywhere. We have to move out. And we'll soon be down in Eamon's constituency. But it's always good for us to see that highly educated people from Trinity and all the other universities take all the top positions and all buy the best houses from around the country. So, you know, you forgive me if I feel excluded in my own county. But it's interesting to hear your perception of me. That's not how it is if you're from Dublin, as I am from central Dublin. But listen, let's on a serious note, I think the point's well made, and I think it is a battle all of the time to try and get an understanding on this great island of ours. I think Eamon and I come from the same tradition, so you'd have to say that I would agree with a number of points he made, but I think it is always, and I grew up in a family that Northern Ireland was always debated. In fact, I used to think sometimes growing up that was there only one place in the country or in the world that was Northern Ireland. It was always debated by Northern Ireland. When I joined my political party, they spoke about nothing else. And began to think, would we not be interested in some of the social issues around us coming from central Dublin as I do? That it was always about the north. It was always about, you know, how can we make it work together? And how can we get on together? And I came up with a tradition of watching Prime Minister Clark and O'Neill and others, and wondering if there was some way that we could all work together someday to that it didn't always have to be the way that it was. And I had the great honour and pleasure of working with so many people from your tradition, Stephen, working successfully with them and getting to understand them, and even more so with Loyalists. A huge, unlike the D4 guys, which I understand because they're probably, parents are probably not from Dublin anyway. but unlike them, I have a huge amount of friends in Northern Ireland, in every part of Northern Ireland, in every political persuasion, and of all religious persuasions that I've known. And a great regard for them all, and I think we have to continue to work together. But I think the point that was made at the very start, I think by Emma, that, you know, from 1921, it got off to a wrong start. A lot of people think 1921, the whole debate was about partition. Of course, it wasn't. And in 1921, the debate wasn't about partition at all, because everyone thought that was part into the 25 boundary commission. I agree with your remarks of what the sellout of the boundary commission was. For different reasons than you did, but because it would have been a different structure of the island of Ireland that the Boundary Commission had done what had been promised by the British leadership at the time. But unfortunately, our delegation weren't as bright as the British delegation, and were sold a pub. But so be it, but it did get everything off a wrong way. But I remember years later, when I went to Conway Mills in the 90s, Deputy Crowe was with me actually on that day at Conway Mills, and a very old woman in her 90s came to me. She said, "You're very welcome, Bertie." When I was a very young child, Eamon de Valera was the last one to call here. that was 1920 something or 30 something, so there was that long gap. But I think in recent years, and this is I think the key point, the North South bodies, and I worked with David Trimble and those, and everyone here is, or almost everybody here is too young to remember all the debates about that. But we've genuinely tried to get extensive North-South cooperation, a whole range of areas, that in the years ahead that we would be able to work on education and health and rural development on roads and everything else, and trying to join up the country in a way that wasn't takeover, just to get on with the work. And David Trimble, who had a great time for, a great respect for, he said to me, you know, I can't just sell this, but what I can do is that we get these bodies going. They don't have to be legislative, they don't have to be statutory orders, that people will just incrementally work together and cooperate together and do all these things. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. And I think a lot of what's happened in the last 25 years is very sad to me, because the North-South bodies, and it's over blaming anybody, I'm not here to lecture who's to blame, because that gets us nowhere. But what's happened is that very little of that happened. And even the meetings were there, that were on, and Eamon and Stephen will know this very well, that the meetings were, you know, too formal. People were reading from a briefing sheet, and you know, we weren't really making any decisions. So what should have happened incrementally, where people were working together, cooperating together, hasn't happened. And everything was estranged. And the advice I used to get from officials would be very careful, you know, don't offend them, don't upset them. Now, I never actually took that advice, because we always went out and we worked and we talked to DUP, we worked out to UUP, dealing with SDLP, the Alliance, Women's Coalition, we were there, or whatever it was, to try and build up cooperation. And I just hope now, we've lost a lot of years, and it's your generation now in the various posts that I hope you'll have, whether you're in the civil service, public service, private sector, whatever professions you take up. Because the only way we'll ever make this island really work to its full potential is not to be worrying about whether it's in United Ireland or New Ireland, but how we can all work in whatever facet we are, whether we're footballers or whether we're cardiologists, whether we're engineers or public servants, that we work to try and cooperate, and to whatever organisation you're in, that you're trying to make an all-island basis work. And so I was a bit, one political point I made, I wasn't overexcited about the recent commands paper, because what the recent command paper, which is a statutory instrument, I think, Steve, what the command paper is trying to do is to rewrite the East-West part of the agreement of 1998. Now, in my view, that, forget about whether I think it's a good idea or a bad idea, but I think it's not a good idea for your generation. Because the success for Northern Ireland for the future is the island economy that was not something that a southern Dublin politician brought up. It was Sir George Quigley, Presbyterian business person, put forward when I was finance minister over 30 years ago. And the success is to build the all-island economy, build the internal British economy, which Northern Ireland is part of, and to build the European economy that you're in for goods. That's the success, and that's what will bring, I think, happiness, peace, and wealth to Northern Ireland into the future. And I think that's the road we should go, and the South should pay its part. It shouldn't be in trying to frustrate the island economy, or to frustrate the British internal economy, but we should be trying to build the island economy, and where it's helpful to cooperate in the other areas. And I think that's the challenge. So to all of you, my best wishes to you. You're the future. You know the old sayings, the rebels of today and the revolutionaries of today are the conservatives of tomorrow. I know all the students that I knew growing up, now you have to pay 250 quid to go in and see them for 5 minutes, get their tooth out. So, if you if you have a legal bill, costs about £1,000 per minute. I wish you all well into your future. I hope some of you follow the political end. Politics is a much maligned profession, but it is the one that carries a lot of influence. And even if you don't want to be directly involved, it's good to be in a political movement. I'm giving like Eamon and Ian and Steve time to try to build a better society, because in a democracy, it is the political system that strives to do these things and to help influence these things. And this is your generation to build on the mistakes of the past and the good things of the past. And I hope you do play your part in that. To you, Auditor, to you, President, it's a great honour to be with you today. Thanks for inviting me, and I wish you well for the future.
Well, I'd like to call Daniel to say a few words on behalf of the Society and the HIS.
Thank you very much. On behalf of both the Literacy and the HIS, I'd like to thank our guest chair, Bertie Hearn, for agreeing to chair the debate and coming up to the Hill today. It's fantastic to have you here, and I look forward to welcoming you back to Northern Ireland and hopefully the Literacy very soon, as you become quite the celebrity within our society. Additionally, we'd like to thank our host and sponsor, Carol Hunter MLA, who very kindly agreed to support the Literacy and the HIS in hopes of all this important debate that's on here today. Cara is a long-standing friend of the Society who has supported the Literacy on a number of occasions, and we're very grateful that she's took time out of her schedule to be with us today. Thank you also to our guest speakers and student speakers for participation in the debate. We're delighted that we've heard speakers from both unionist, nationalist backgrounds in debating motion, speakers from both Northern Ireland and the Republic, and speakers from both debating societies. It's great to see such vibrant cross-border collaboration, and both the Literacy and the HIS have a vast array of programmes and events for the rest of the semester. If you're attending today but are members of neither society, I would strongly encourage you to join with one of us. On the Literacy side, we have weekly ordinary meetings with notable guest speakers, as well as a number of talks and great debates just like this one. And finally, thank you from myself and the Literacy Council to Anya and Malika from the HIS, who have worked tirelessly with us to make sure this event takes place. We look forward to collaborating with you in the future. Just before we leave, there is a social event taking place, which I believe Dylan is going to announce for us now.
So, to all of our students, guests, and even in the DLP, very welcome to join us at Kelly Cellars in town. So, very nice bar to do very good Guinness. The upstairs were booked out. So, Southerners, you don't know how to get there, try and follow a Nordic. We'll try and guide you down to the glider. It is not like the Lewis, it's not free, you have to buy a ticket. Or if you're really, really fast, give it a shot. But yeah, you're very welcome to join us. We have a book from 6:30 onwards until close.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I call this house adjourned, and I thank everybody from both societies that worked really hard. And I know just from the contacts we've had over the months, a lot of people, others from present and their people, worked really, really hard to make today's success. So congratulations to them.